Looking for a fabulous fashion brand that celebrates you? Then look no further than Boston Proper, where styles are designed with you in mind, so you can look and feel amazing, no matter the day, season, or occasion. At bostonproper.com, you'll find fashion that knows you best. For over 30 years, Boston Proper has been the fashion destination for confident women who want to elevate their look with unique, sophisticated clothing at affordable prices. Visit bostonproper.com today. Boston Proper. Wear it like no one else.
Life in our modern age comes at you pretty fast, which makes our time away especially valuable. When I take time to relax, I like to get far from my everyday life, immerse myself in natural beauty, and have unique experiences. But you don't have to leave the U.S. to experience tropical rainforests and islands filled with adventure, warm culture, and national treasures. Visit Puerto Rico, an island with a vibrant spirit that will sweep you away. Because when you visit, you don't become part of the island, it becomes part of you. In Puerto Rico, you can forget where you came from and embrace where you are. Puerto Rico, where visits end, but stories last forever. No passport required for U.S. citizens and permanent residents. Learn more and plan your trip at discoverpuertorico.com.
Hey, everyone. We want to announce that we have our final three shows of the year on the books. August 12th in Orlando, Florida. September 6th in Nashville, Tennessee. And winding it up right here in Atlanta, September 9th.
They're going to be great. Just great. Great, great, great. So if you want to come see the Stuff You Should Know greatness, the last of it for the year, you can by going to stuffyoushouldknow.com and checking out our tour page or going to linktree/SYSK. Either way, you'll get links to tickets and all the info you need. We'll see you starting in August.
Welcome to Stuff You Should Know, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, and welcome to the podcast. I'm Josh, and there's Chuck, and Jerry's here too. And that makes this Stuff You Should Know. Let's eat.
That's right. This is about James Beard the Human and the James Beard Foundation and Awards. Big thanks to Dave Ruse, who helped us put this together. And I also got a lot of stuff from a writer, a bunch of interviews and magazine articles on this guy, John Birdsall, who wrote a book called The Man Who Ate Too Much. About James Beard, about James Beard and James Beard through the lens of sort of what it was like to be a closeted gay man in the, you know, starting in the early 1900s in the United States.
Yeah, one of the things about the internet is when something comes along that's kind of definitive, most of the stuff that turns up on a search engine is interpretation of that.
Yeah.
It's a bunch of different reviews of, in this case, of a book or think pieces, you know, based on the book, whatever. But if you dig hard enough, you can find like definitive articles as well. And this is a case of that. And it's really interesting to see things that were written about James Beard in 1997 or 2010 or whatever, anytime before 2020 when John Birdsall's book came out. And it's just totally different. It's so much more surface level and accepting him as who he was, basically, or taking on face that he was who he seemed to be. And then now, after that, it's like there's meditations on, you know, whether he actually hated being gay like a friend said he did, or did he hate being gay in the mid-20th century?
Right.
Like, just it's just a completely different approach to James Beard. And certainly it's a lot more robust and well-rounded and thoughtful, but in some ways it's like, man, it's too bad we can't go back to the happier interpretation of James Beard, but that's just not how it goes.
Yeah. So who we're talking about is, like we said, James Beard. If you are into food, if you're into restaurants, if you are into cooking shows and reading cookbooks and foodie culture, then James Beard is a very big name, because if you get a James Beard Award for your podcast or your restaurant critic column or your cookbook, or most importantly, for your restaurant or as a chef, then that means fame and fortune and all the things that go with winning a major award, as if it were a Tony or an Oscar or a Emmy or whatever.
Yeah, because that is generally how it's viewed, as the Oscars of food.
Until the Oscars said to stop saying that.
Yeah, they did. Apparently, the James Beard Awards were broadcast on Food Network in the 90s. And they call it the culinary Oscars.
Right.
And the Oscars, yeah, they were like, please don't do that anymore. We're going to sue you.
Yeah, and we'll get into his early history, but he is or was a chef and a cookbook writer and a business owner. He was probably the first American celebrity chef and really formed the mold for all to follow of chef as brand. He had an encyclopedic knowledge of food. I saw some cool interviews with different like legendary chefs that were like, he knew more about every type of food you could imagine and every ingredient on planet Earth than anyone that I've ever met. And this is like Alice Waters and Jacques Pepin and like the legendary chefs of the world.
Yeah. Yeah. He's very highly regarded, highly thought of. And what's amazing is he was self-taught, basically. He had a lot of influences along the way, but he never had any formal training in cooking.
Yeah, yet he started what we now call farm-to-table cuisine and new American cuisine, because from the very beginning, he was like, it's just got to taste good. It's simple ingredients put together in a non-fussy way is the way it's best to cook and eat. And now that's people are all about that, but that's sort of a more recent sort of resurgence of that kind of thing.
Yeah. And I mean, if you took him now or back then and just fast forwarded him to now, the only two differences would be he'd be allowed to be out as Gary and he would have to get both of his sleeves fully tatted.
Right.
That's it. Because that's like we just finally kind of caught up to his vibe.
Totally.
He established it.
All right. So should we go back to the beginning?
Let's.
All right. Let's go back to Portland, Oregon, then in 1903. I can't imagine what Portland could have possibly been like growing up as a kid in the 1910s and teens.
I bet there was a lot of horses and rugged people.
Probably so. In his own memoir, he semi-accurately described his life as very idyllic in the sense that from the very beginning, he grew up eating great food for a couple of reasons. For three reasons, really. One is because where he lived in Oregon near the coast, they had great fresh seafood everywhere and forest everywhere. So these great wild berries and vegetables or organic stuff, because that's just everything was basically organic pre-mass farming and pesticide.
Right, totally.
And the other two reasons are that his mom, who was an English woman named Elizabeth Beard, was very much into good food and like making sure her son ate like really great stuff and the finest things because they had some money and he was pretty spoiled.
He was an only child, right?
Yeah, I think so. And then the other was his, who ended up being kind of his godfather because apparently his dad wasn't a very good guy, which was a Cantonese immigrant chef who was the chef of the house named Juliette, who they were very, very close. And from a very early age, James Beard was exposed to Chinese and Asian cooking, Cantonese cooking in particular. I believe that Juliette was also a master bread maker. And Portland has one of the oldest Chinatowns in the U.S. So as a young kid, he was being exposed to all kinds of great cuisines thanks to the, I think, live-in chef.
Yeah, and if you put those two together, you get a really good approximation of what he did. He created American cuisine at a time, like when he really kind of became a public figure, it was at the exact same time that we were learning how to make frozen foods and building TV trays. And there was a whole Gee Whiz thing to like aluminum foil and stuff like that. So he pushed against that and said, no, we want fresh stuff. We want seasonal stuff. You don't want stuff that was picked 6 months ago and frozen ever since. And a lot of America was like, yeah, we do. This is amazing. This is like the space age in the future. Sit down. And then on the Juliette influence was to take other cultures' dishes and Americanize them in certain ways, just swapping out ingredients, changing the name, and just making it that much more approachable. But it's still something that, you know, it's still an exotic dish, but it's an exotic dish that he's explaining the average American cook who's interested can go do.
Yeah, for sure. Like I said, his dad was not a great dude, wasn't around that much. His mom, who I mentioned, was born in England, was she ran the family. They had a boarding house called the Gladstone in Portland. And she ran that and apparently was a perfectionist and very domineering. So while she was, you know, orchestrating all these gourmet meals for her young son, I get the idea that it wasn't the easiest sort of home life with her perfectionism and domineering qualities.
Yeah, but you didn't get that from his memoir, which is another good kind of sketch of what he was like. He presented himself totally differently as a public figure than, I don't want to say totally differently, but much differently, especially as he became more and more of a public figure than who he was in real life. Or he was very good at embellishing anecdotes or, you know, he realized the value of the backstory to a recipe would make people want to make it more. And then they could share that when they cooked it for their friends.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. He went to Reed College there in Portland and ended up being asked to leave Reed College, basically expelled his freshman year in 1921 because he had a couple of affairs with other students and one with a professor where apparently some of his roommates actually witnessed this, like walked in on them. Mm. And they very quietly said, you've got to get out of here. And I don't know if being gay was illegal in Oregon at the time, but it was illegal in some states. And it wouldn't surprise me if Oregon was one of them. But they said, you got to get out of here. And the yearbook hadn't even been published yet. And they erased every mention of him in their yearbook before it published.
Yeah. Which, depending on who you ask, either like scarred him for life when he secretly held it as a mark of shame. And maybe that was one of the reasons why he hated being gay. Or he just, you know, rolled with it and moved on. I'm not quite sure which is correct, but either way, he still had a deep and abiding love for Reed College and left most of his estate to Reed College after he died.
Yeah, I don't know. I wonder why that happened, because I know they eventually came around once he got famous and were like, oh, he's a very famous Reedy, and they gave him a honorary degree many years later in 1976. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. It still surprises me that he, just for being there 1 year, that he, I don't know, left him that kind of endowment.
Yeah, not even 1 year. He didn't even make it through his freshman year.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's surprising. Because he also could have been like, oh, you want me to be a Reedy now? Shove it. But he didn't. He was very pleased to have been given an honorary degree. So after college, his little stint in college, he's like, you know what? I want to be an actor. Maybe an opera singer. My family's pretty wealthy, so I'm just going to go to Europe, joining a traveling theater company, and study my craft in Europe. Mm-hmm. There he learned, I think, the hard way that he had a mediocre talent, I saw it described. But in like Paris and London and some of the great European capitals, he found like, oh my gosh, there's like these gay communities are just barely on the down low. Like they're, you know, they have great parties and they have their own bars and places to go. Like it's totally unlike America. So in that sense, I think he learned to appreciate being gay or at least interacting with the gay community for the first time there in Europe, which would have been a great education for him.
Yeah. And he spent the next, I don't know, 15 or so years moving around a lot, still trying to work in theater and doing, also getting involved in cooking some. And I think 24, he moved back to Portland, worked as a radio announcer, and again, joined another theater troupe. Mm-hmm. 27, moved to L.A. for a little while and actually got a couple of bit parts in Cecil B. DeMille movies.
Oh, yeah?
Very small parts, though, you know, kind of just like you were saying. Apparently, he could sing and act. It just was, you know, he was right there in the middle.
Right, yeah.
But it wasn't like, oh, like he had no talent whatsoever and he was just some rich kid. Mm-hmm. In 28, he went back to Portland, more local theater, and then started spending a lot of time in Seattle. Did a semester at Carnegie Tech in Pittsburgh, where he studied like scenic design and costume design and stuff. So he was really still trying to do the theater thing.
Right.
And that's what he was still trying to do when he moved to New York in 1937.
Yeah, and that he didn't aspire to be a chef. He basically did it to make ends meet. That's when he started. When he was in New York, he fell in with the gay community there, which was super underground. Apparently, at the time in the 1930s, even in New York, you couldn't even hint that you were gay. Like, you just did not, at least not in public. So you couldn't go out to bars because bars didn't want you. They could lose their license if they were caught with a gay person in on the premises. What the gay community did in New York was throw private parties at people's houses. And what he did was he started hiring himself out to cook for these parties. And he got particularly good at creating cocktail party food, finger foods, canapés, hors d'oeuvres, that kind of stuff. So much so that he ended up writing his first cookbook on that, which we'll talk about in a second.
Yeah. And all this New York stuff, this is post-prohibition. Like, there were gay bars in New York pre-prohibition, which I didn't even realize.
No, I didn't either.
But they basically used prohibition once things started, post-prohibition, once things finally started opening up again, to say, okay, but here's the deal, like, no more gay bars.
Yeah, it's just history, it's crazy. It's just a back and forth of progressive and conservative, progressive and conservative, like a seesaw. It's interesting, because you tend to think of everything just kind of moving forward,
right,
which would be progressiveness, but it doesn't always.
No, it doesn't. You're talking about those cocktail parties in New York where he was making food. He ended up meeting a very key person in his life named James Cullum, who was a wealthy gay socialite. And he said, hey, why don't you move in with me? I got a spare room and you can kind of be I throw these huge parties and you're great at this. And you can kind of be my live-in cater chef, essentially. Mm-hmm. And it was like a completely platonic thing, but he moved in. Through Cullum, he was able to work all these other parties, meet all the sort of well-heeled gay New Yorkers with money. And like you said, he made quite a name for himself. And he was doing this, like you said, with these sort of simple hors d'oeuvres and finger foods that he would make his own. One thing that he's still very famous for was his onion sandwich.
Yeah.
I looked up this thing. I got to make one now.
Really? I was not inspired to.
Oh, man, I think they look delicious. I saw Jacques Pepin make one. Maybe that had something to do with it.
Sure.
But you take some brioche and you cut, like use a biscuit cutter or something to cut it into a circle so it doesn't have any crust. Mm-hmm. You cut two of these. You make up some homemade mayo, okay. Ideally,
right.
Or Duke's if you're in a pinch. And then you spread mayo on each side. You slice very thinly. You cut an onion in half and then very thinly slice, you know, a half moon of onion and a half moon of onion. And put those together so it is, you know, covering the whole sandwich.
Right.
And then you spread mayo along the outer rim of the sandwich once you put it together. Mm-hmm. And then roll that in either chopped parsley or some combination of chopped herbs that you like.
Mm.
And it looked really good and it looks very simple. And everyone goes nuts on it. So I've got to try it.
Okay. Well, let me know how it is. And if it is particularly good, I'll try it for sure. It's not like I'm like, that's gross. I'm like, this is missing something that would make me want to eat it. Like, where's the deli meat?
He apparently wealthy, and this is something Birdsall wrote about, that like wealthy straight parties at the time, they had like really fancy stuff like, you know, caviar and truffles. But the food itself, apparently, and the finger foods and sandwiches are all kind of boring.
Yeah.
And apparently this stuff was just way better and more creative.
Yeah. So, again, he made his name as a catering chef. He founded a company called Hors d'oeuvre Inc. with a brother and sister, Bill and Irma Rode. And at the same time, he learned a lot from these people. He also learned a lot from a woman named Jean Wilson, who was a socialite in New York. And all three of them kind of took him under their wing. Taught him things like the value of like going out and finding good ingredients at stores in New York, how to appreciate wine or at least pretend like you understand how to appreciate wine. From Bill Rode, he learned the value of adding a backstory to a dish, how important that was. If his education came in like peaks and valleys, this was another big peak. In his culinary education, you could say. And he went on in, I think, 1940, just a few years after he started cooking, I think, right? Didn't you say it was 37 that he really started?
I mean, he moved to New York in 37 and I think kind of ditched everything else in like 38 and 39.
Okay. So in 3 years, he went from teaching himself how to cook, basically, hanging out with New York society, to writing his first cookbook in 1940, which he claimed to have written in 6 weeks.
Yeah. Shortly thereafter, and I guess we'll take a break after this, but he was drafted into the Army. I saw he enlisted and that he was drafted, so I'm not sure which is true, but I saw drafted more often than enlisted. And that ended his catering business for a couple of reasons. I think even before he was drafted, the food rationing basically ended that catering business. But he was drafted in 42 into a cryptography school and served in the U.S. Seaman Service in places like Brazil and Puerto Rico and Panama and France. So he's, in a way, still kind of continuing his food education by living in these places with awesome food.
Man, that's super interesting.
Should we take that break?
Yeah, let's.
All right, we'll be right back with more on James Beard.
Learning stuff with Joshua and Charles. Stuff you should know.
Do you love fashion? Do you love getting compliments on how well you're dressed? Are you always seeking the latest trends? Then we're talking to you. BostonProper.com is your fashion destination and the only place to go for all those nods, head turns, and new styles. No matter the day, season, or occasion, Boston Proper has what you're looking for. Sophisticated, confident clothing designed to flatter and get noticed. So visit BostonProper.com now and start creating your perfect wardrobe. Boston Proper. Wear it like no one else.
All right, game off. Let's pause here to talk more about Monopoly Go. Because in Monopoly Go, you can team up with your friends for timed tournaments where you work together to build up each other's boards. It's very nice.
That's right. And the more you win together, the more awesome prizes you unlock. And there's so much to get. I'm talking about unique stickers that you can trade with friends to complete albums for big prizes, cool new playing pieces to travel the boards with, or hilarious emojis for taunting friends when you smash their buildings or heist their vaults.
Plus, Monopoly Go feels new and exciting every day with constantly changing tournaments and challenges, like digging for treasure or a robot pachinko machine. And there's always new timed events that help you win big, like massive multipliers for everything you win or rent frenzies.
That's right. There's always something fun to discover in Monopoly Go. So get off the bench and go download it now for free on Google Play or the App Store. Game on. Hey, everybody. Did you know that Boricua is the name for someone from Puerto Rico? But it's more than just a name. It's a way of life and representation of the vibrant spirit of the island.
Yeah, that's right. It's an island that's filled with adventure around every corner and natural treasures waiting to be explored, like El Yunque, the only tropical rainforest in the entire United States.
That's right. Or you can get swept away by natural beauty and come away with unique stories that could only be experienced in Puerto Rico that remind you of why you travel in the first place.
Visits end, but stories last forever. You don't become a part of the island, it becomes a part of you.
That's right. In Puerto Rico, you can forget where you came from and embrace where you are. No passport required for U.S. citizens and permanent residents. Learn more and plan your trip at discoverpuertorico.com.
Want to learn about a pterosaur and call it pterodactyl? How to take a perfect boob and all about fractals? Genghis Khan, Attila the Hun, the Lizzie Borden murders and the cannibal runs. Gonna explain everything to your brain explodes. Just Chuck and Josh, this stuff you should know.
Word up, Jerry.
All right, so I mentioned Gene Wilson, Bill and Irma Road. They had a huge impact on his culinary education, I should say. Nothing formal, again. Like, there was just hanging out with the right people who kind of provided this and that. And sometimes recipes. He co-owned the catering business with them. But the first chance he got to cut them out credit-wise, he took. In his 1940 cookbook, Hors d'oeuvres and canapés, there's no mention of them. There's no mention of any of the Hors d'oeuvres Inc. or of their ownership in Hors d'oeuvres Inc., I should say. And he kind of, at least in retrospect, became a little bit famous for, at the very least, to put it as nicely as possible, not giving credit where credit is due. At worst, using people and then burning the bridge in an effort to climb ever upward.
I saw that onion sandwich recipe might have even been from the Rhodes.
Yeah.
I'm not sure about that 100%, but that could be an example. He was very prolific, wrote a lot of books from 1940 to 1983. He had 20 cookbooks, including in 1959, sort of his seminal work, the James Beard Cookbook, that had, it was kind of like a kitchen Bible, which apparently he wasn't a big fan of those kinds of books. Uh-huh. And this was not even close to his favorite of his own, but it was the best selling and had everything in there from how to make like a French cassoulet to how to boil water. And was, I think, the first cookbook to feature the chef on the cover. It was just unheard of to do at the time. It was just, you know, the joy of cooking or whatever. You would just have text. And he was the first person to put his mug on there. And again, that's just sort of laid the groundwork for chef as brand. He was this really big guy. He was 6'3", weighed over 300 pounds. He eventually was bald and kind of looked like a Uncle Fester type. but apparently just had no self-consciousness about the way he looked and a bigger person like eating a lot, because he ate a ton and consistently talked about how much he loved to eat a lot of food.
So much so that he had one of the first cooking shows, maybe the first televised cooking show in America in 1946. It was titled I Love to Eat.
That was his catchphrase.
Yeah, he would say that at either the end or the beginning of every one. It only ran for a year. And from what I could tell, that was his only TV show. He'd made some appearances on other shows like The Mike Douglas Show and other stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
But that was his TV show. That was his one TV show. Instead, he ended up making his name more with like cookbooks and a cooking school and all of that. But on that show, apparently you can see the beginnings of that chef brand of his, where, you know, he had a big appetite, but only for delicious food. Right. Mm-hmm. So he had no problem with eating and eating and eating, but it had to be good food. He wasn't going to waste that on any junk.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. And I looked for clips of this show. It's really, I found a couple of short ones. It's really kind of hard to find stuff because he just didn't preserve, you know, we've talked about it before, media like they do now. But I did read in one of the Birdsall interviews where he was saying that despite being in the closet, he would drop. He said gay men at the time, he said they would drop what they called hat pins. Uh-huh. So just little references or a little the way they said something to kind of as code of like, hey, I'm gay. Like, you see what I'm putting down here. Mm-hmm. And he would do that apparently on his TV show. And he would drop little hat pins to sort of to the gay community, at least. So they would know that he was gay. But straight people are just like, well, this guy's just so fun.
Yes. You know? I wonder what community does that now, and we're not aware of it.
Who knows?
I'd be very curious. If you know, listener, write in. But yeah, apparently he was very much like that until that first best-selling cookbook, the James Beard Cookbook, came out. I read that any semblance of that was totally stripped out, and his brand now was a manly man who loved food. And I saw was so so enthralled by food and the good life that he didn't even like a relationship with women wasn't even on his radar. He was too busy enjoying life, kind of thing.
Yeah,
that was kind of how he was presented, starting in the late 50s.
There's a Instagram guy I follow. Oh, I can't remember. I wouldn't be able to pronounce it anyway because he's like Danish or something. I'm not sure what he is, but he lives in the beautiful mountains of one of those Scandinavian countries.
Daneland? And
I don't know. But his stuff is great because he cooks sort of this, like, great-looking food, but in a very tuk-tuk way. It's like a big, he'll cook it on a big stone that's been heated by this fire he makes himself. But it's like really elevated sort of camping food. And he gives stuff to his dog at the end of every one. And he never speaks or anything. It's all,
yeah?
It's all silent.
Wait a minute.
Have you seen this?
But is he like a kind of like a wild man and he lives in a tent?
He is a wild man in a tent.
Yes, I have seen it. And he'll point to stuff.
Yeah.
But
he may not speak English. But I was just thinking, like, nothing would make me happier than if at the end of one of these, like, some guy just walks in from the mountains and they just start making out at the end.
Sure, right.
I'd be like, all right, there you go, man.
There you go, James Beard. Do it.
So we talked about the fact that he would present, you know, sort of fancy foods in a simpler way for Americans that may have been intimidated by, like, you know, the classic French cooking and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And one good example is in his cookbook from 1949, The Fireside Cookbook, when he basically made what is an omelette paysan, which is a French for peasant omelette.
Yeah.
But he called it a country omelette. And all he did was putting salted pork belly in this omelet that also has potatoes, onions, and parsley was put in smoked bacon, and he called it a country omelet, and it just seemed completely American.
Yeah, that was it. That's what he would do. Like, he would, I guess in the parlance of today, he would appropriate other cultures' food and alter it just enough to make it Americanized. He wasn't doing it, from what I could tell, because he was unimaginative, because he couldn't come up with his own stuff. It was from an appreciation of those other cultures' dishes, and he was Americanizing it, not out of a disrespect to that culture originating it, but out of making it more accessible to American cooks. And in doing that, he is credited with basically coming up with American cuisine. And it's hilarious, but it's so American that American cuisine is predicated on other cultures' food. And it owes a huge debt to French cooking. And in large part, it's because people like James Beard, and James Beard in particular, took French food and Americanized it and made American cuisine in the process.
Yeah. Dave makes a very good point. Like, if you think of the 1960s, what might be in a recipe book or a menu, you probably aren't, because like you said, that was sort of when TV dinners were all the rage and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And it just didn't seem like there was a lot of attention being paid to real quality like that.
Yeah.
But that's all come back in a big way. And if you read some of his recipes from the 1960s, and they say, and he's writing about roasted figs and prosciutto and sunchokes and ceviche and stuff like that. Like, I didn't know about any of that stuff in the 80s and 90s even, probably. And he was writing about this stuff in the 1950s and 60s.
It started to become a thing in the 80s with the yuppies. Started to, and they can thank James Beard for that. But like,
you're just thinking of American Psycho.
Well, I am totally. At what is it?
Is it Le Cirque?
No. I should
not
know
Spago,
this.
That's L.A. What was it?
I don't know. We'll
oh,
figure
man.
It out.
That scene with the business cards is so good.
It is great. So yes, but that's exactly what I was thinking of.
But you're right.
So. Yes, but before that, like, there's an example of him in his TV show in 1945 or 6 talking about this exotic oil that people should go root out. Like, it's hard to find, but it's worth the effort. And it was called olive oil.
Yeah.
And this was a time when that was not, you could not find that anywhere, maybe in like Little Italy. But you did not find it like mass produced in your grocery store.
It's like you use lard.
Exactly. And one of the reasons why you find it mass produced in your grocery store now is because James Beard introduced it to America. Like, that's the effect that this guy had. He's everywhere. His influence is everywhere still today. And not just still today, like finally today, his influence has really kind of come into full fruition.
Yeah, agreed.
I love talking about food.
Me too, man. I'm hungry. Should we take that second break?
Sure. Let's go.
All right.
Let's go get some onion sandwiches.
All right. Well, and we'll talk about the James Beard Foundation and his legacy right after this.
Learning stuff with Joshua and Charles. Stuff you should know.
Do you love fashion? Do you love getting compliments on how well you're dressed? Are you always seeking the latest trends? Then we're talking to you. BostonProper.com is your fashion destination and the only place to go for all those nods, head turns, and new styles. No matter the day, season, or occasion, Boston Proper has what you're looking for. Sophisticated, confident clothing designed to flatter and get noticed. So visit BostonProper.com now and start creating your perfect wardrobe. Boston Proper. Wear it like no one else.
All right, game off. Let's pause here to talk more about Monopoly Go. Because in Monopoly Go, you can team up with your friends for timed tournaments where you work together to build up each other's boards. It's very nice.
That's right. And the more you win together, the more awesome prizes you unlock. And there's so much to get. I'm talking about unique stickers that you can trade with friends to complete albums for big prizes, cool new playing pieces to travel the boards with, or hilarious emojis for taunting friends when you smash their buildings or heist their vaults.
Plus, Monopoly Go feels new and exciting every day with constantly changing tournaments and challenges, like digging for treasure or a robot pachinko machine. And there's always new timed events that help you win big, like massive multipliers for everything you win or rent frenzies.
That's right. There's always something fun to discover in Monopoly Go. So get off the bench and go download it now for free on Google Play or the App Store. Game on. Hey, everybody. Did you know that Boricua is the name for someone from Puerto Rico? But it's more than just a name. It's a way of life and representation of the vibrant spirit of the island.
Yeah, that's right. It's an island that's filled with adventure around every corner and natural treasures waiting to be explored, like El Yunque, the only tropical rainforest in the entire United States.
That's right. Or you can get swept away by natural beauty and come away with unique stories that could only be experienced in Puerto Rico that remind you of why you travel in the first place.
Visits end, but stories last forever. You don't become a part of the island, it becomes a part of you.
That's right. In Puerto Rico, you can forget where you came from and embrace where you are. No passport required for U.S. citizens and permanent residents. Learn more and plan your trip at discoverpuertorico.com.
Want to learn about a pterosaur and call it pterodactyl? How to take a perfect poop and all about fractals? Genghis Khan, Attila the Hun, the Lizzie Borden murders and the cannibal runs. Gonna explain everything to your brain explodes. Just Chuck and Josh, this stuff you should know. Word up, Jerry.
Okay, so now we move on. Now that we know the man, pretty good 30 minutes on James Beard.
I think so.
We'll talk about his foundation. In the 70s, in New York, he bought a townhouse at 167 West 12th Street in Greenwich Village. And now he was sort of a little more on the down low. He wasn't on TV as much. He wasn't, he was still writing cookbooks, but he was just a little more private, I guess, at that point. He was free in the 70s in New York, especially in Greenwich Village, to be a little more out. Although he, you know, apparently he was just sort of a homebody with his longtime partner, who was a pastry chef, Gino Cofacci, and would, again, throw these great parties, these great holiday meals. In 1981, he started, and this is a big part of his legacy today, he founded with restaurant critic Gail Green, City Meals on Wheels. And to date, and this is basically, it's not officially Meals on Wheels, but just a similar thing that covers New York City. They have served, since 1981, 50 million meals to people who can't get out of the house in New York.
That's amazing. And I was like, wait a minute, was this the beginning of Meals on Wheels? And no, it wasn't. And apparently Meals on Wheels have been around since the 40s, which I'm sure we talked about in our Meals on Wheels episode. But still,
that's right.
It's definitely worth tipping your hat to, for sure.
Absolutely.
So the whole thing started, the James Beard Foundation, in an effort to buy back his Greenwich Village townhouse from Reed College. Remember, he'd left the bulk of his estate to Reed. And I get the impression it's one of his students who became a colleague, Peter Kump, who kind of took the reins of this and got other people, including Julia Child, kind of to champion this cause. And it was wildly successful because James Beard died in 1985 and they owned the townhouse by 1986. So then they're like, okay, what do we do next?
Yeah, and he, by the way, lived to be 81. So despite his size and how much kind of rich foods he ate, 81's not too bad.
Not bad at all.
Heart failure finally got him. But in like you said, they got the James Beard House, which they renamed officially the James Beard House. Yeah. Still there today. And I think their first sort of mission was to, quote, provide a center for the culinary arts and to continue to foster interest, the interest James Beard inspired in all aspects of food, its preparation, presentation, and, of course, enjoyment. And, you know, it was sort of a humble start, I think, for what ended up being a very big deal. And part of that was kind of kicked off the very next year in 1987 when Wolfgang Puck,
who was known as
so fun to listen to.
He is. I love hearing that guy talk. And at the time, back then, he was known as Walter Pugowski still.
Was that his name?
No.
Oh, God, I believe every joke you tell lately.
I know. I'm killing it.
Oh, gosh. I would love to hear a interview or just a conversation between Wolfgang Puck and Werner Herzog.
Yeah, totally.
That would be the best.
It'd be mesmerizing. Puck said,
hey, can I host a dinner at your house? And they said, sure, you can come and cook at the James Beard House and host a dinner. And it was a big hit, apparently. So he said, why don't we do this like once a month? Have these big dinners prepared by either big famous chefs or someone who's up and coming. And all of a sudden, the James Beard House itself starts to get its own reputation.
Yes. Which I'll bet a dinner there's at once really great and mm-hmm. also very trying to hear some of the people around the table talking about it.
Oh, man, I want to. If someone has an inn, invite Josh and I and you, me, and Emily to come.
Okay, yeah. But if please. I'm sitting there like rolling my eyes, don't get mad.
Okay. The onion sandwich, please.
So this Peter Kump guy, he's like, I'm going to memorialize my teacher one way or another. I mentioned Julia Child, really. I don't know if we said that she and James Beard were very good friends.
Yeah.
And at a time, probably 70s, 80s, they were the two most well-known chefs in America, mm-hmm. far and away. Which is remarkable because, again, neither one of them were formally trained. I think they were both self-taught.
Yeah.
So Julia Child's on board, but Peter Kump is really kind of running the show here. And they start handing out awards pretty quickly after the Beard House is established and the Beard Foundation is established. And at the time, they give the award out for Great American Chefs. And you could expect a certificate. Mm-hmm. A commemorative chef's knife.
Nice.
And that's about it at the time for the first few iterations of this award.
Yeah. Like, of course, a little recognition for those in the know. But it's not like now where a lot of people now are like, oh, it's a James Beard restaurant. We got to go there.
Totally.
Like just from people watching, you know, Food Network and stuff like that. In 1990, so they just had bought this house in the, what, like 80... What did you say, 87?
86.
86, and got things going sort of in the late 80s. And then in 1990, the publisher of the Who's Who of Cooking in America said, you know what, we'd like to sell this property. And Kump said, I'll take it, and bought the rights to, at the time, it was sort of the best honors book for top chefs. Mm-hmm. And he said, well, here, let's expand it, though. And let's not have just chefs, but let's have food critics and restaurants and wine sommeliers and wine people and cookbooks and eventually, you know, podcasts and blogs. And let's give awards for all kinds of things. And eventually that became the James Beard Chef and Restaurant Awards that we still have today.
Yeah, I think they actually had them in parallel for a little while. And then they shut down the Who's Who of Cooking in America because those awards were only given out by previous award winners. So it became kind of an Ouroboros. It wasn't very expansive. Mm. It was very mm-hmm. tight-knit. But the James Beard Chef and Restaurant Awards, at the very least, were meant to be more far-looking than the Who's Who of Cooking in America was.
Yeah.
Whether they achieved that or not depends on who you ask and what year you asked it. But eventually in the early 90s, it started to become... you could see the outlines of the prestigious award that it is today.
Yeah, for sure. The first awards in 91 were held on the MS New Yorker cruise ship, dinner cruise ship. And the best chef, and they give them out, I think New York, Texas, and California now each are their own region. And then everyone else is split up into like Southeast and Northeast and stuff like that.
Flyover states. But,
exactly. But that first year, see if you recognize any of these names. The very first year of those awards, Southeast winner was Emeril Lagasse.
Isn't he the one who'd be like, I guarantee?
No. Huh.
Well, then no, I haven't heard of him.
He's the BAM guy. The Midwest was Chef Rick Bayless. Bobby Flay won Rising Star Chef.
Wasn't he married to the actor from Law and Order?
Bobby Flay?
The assistant DA for a while?
Oh, I don't know.
Yeah.
Maybe.
That's a yes.
A chef, Nancy Silverton, who is a legend, won Pastry Chef in 91, mm-hmm. then won for her restaurant Campanile in 2001, and then won for Best Overall Chef in 2014. So she's a three-time winner. And if you're wondering who won Best Outstanding or Overall Outstanding Chef that very first year.
Hey, look at me. It's Wolfgang Puck.
Oh, really?
Very first winner.
Very nice. That's appropriate because he helped put the James Beard House on the map.
Oh, and also quickly for you wine lovers, Robert Mondavi won Outstanding Wine and Spirits Professional that very first year. And Mondavi is now, like, you know, a wine legend.
Right. And it's hard to stop and imagine. But at the time, these were all, like, unknowns in America, yeah. You know? And I don't think it's coincidence that they're all household names now with huge brands and huge mega money-making careers behind them because of the James Beard Awards, at least in some large part.
Yeah, I think restaurants who have been nominated, just nominated for a Beard Award, says that they typically double their reservations and they increase their sales by 20 to 25%.
Not all, though. I saw an interview with a guy named Jason Wilson who had a restaurant called Crush in Seattle back in the mid, I think like 2010 or 11. He won Best Chef. And mm-hmm. He said, nope, it did not have that effect. Like, people talked about it more, but it didn't get more people in the restaurant. From what I can tell, though, he was an outlier in that respect.
Yeah, I thought you were going to say he won in March of 2020. And just couldn't understand why people weren't backing it
well,
up.
Well, he actually did cite the economic downturn as one reason why it wasn't happening. And he was talking about the 2008 meltdown that was still going on. Remember, that lasted easily until 2012 or 13. And he won in 2010. So he was sitting there griping.
So we need to talk about the controversies of the Beard Awards, though, because they've had a few things that happened over the years. Any award ceremony is going to have controversies. That's just how it goes. Anytime you have a body of people doling out awards that are meaningful and economically impactful, mm-hmm. it's going to happen.
Especially when it's a group of almost exclusively white people.
Yeah, well, that comes up a little later, kind of recently. But in 2004, they had a chairman named Leonard Pickle, I guess, senior or junior. I don't think it's pronounced Pickle. Mm-hmm. P-I-C-K-E-L-L. And he was convicted of grand larceny, I think second-degree grand larceny, for basically stealing about $1 million in cash or, expensing things he shouldn't expense over a three-year period. Mm. Like, those were the foundation's money. And they have a lot of, you know, scholarships that they dole out, too. So that's a big deal if you're stealing from them. He spent a few years in prison. The board resigned. There were a bunch of journalists who were judges that resigned. They came back from that. And then, you know, Mario Batali comes along. The Me Too movement comes along. And all of a sudden, there's people that are saying, like, wait a minute. A lot of these chefs you're nominating and acknowledging are monsters.
Yeah.
Either literal sexual assaulters, or they're just, you know, chefs can be well known for being sort of monsters in the kitchen and screaming and yelling at people. And, you know, they have tempers, generally speaking.
True. But I saw, and it makes a lot of sense, you can really blame Food Network producers and other network producers who created kitchen-based reality shows for mm-hmm. perpetuating that and making it seem normal and creating that whole generation of mean, bullying chefs who would just do that without a second thought, thanks to people like Gordon Ramsay doing that on TV for year after year after year.
But they were already doing it in real life.
Yes, true. But there's also always been chefs that didn't do that too. And it made it trendy to do that. It just made it acceptable for so long that it wasn't until the last few years that people really started pushing back on it and said, no, this isn't normal. It's not okay for our entire industry to be like this. I shouldn't be berated at work every single mm-hmm. night. That's not okay. And so people finally pushed back on it. And the James Beard Awards got caught in the middle of that because they've been awarding all these chefs that were really troublesome people and mean mm-hmm. Over the years, all these awards, award after award after award. So they were also supporting it indirectly. And you can also make a case directly, too. And so once this was kind of established, like, this is not okay, James Beard Awards, you are the arbiter of what is who are good chefs, you got to do something about this too. They kind of went back and said, okay, what are we going to do about this? We've got to do something, because at the very least for optics, we can't keep giving these people awards. And who knows, maybe they actually do care about the industry and the people working in the industry. And in that case, they really needed to reconfigure what they were doing and reevaluate it.
Yeah. And it wasn't just, you know, monsters in the kitchen, but it was a pattern of like, hey, and this is just the history of the restaurant industry. It's like white men are recognized more. They're more, at least in the past.
Just the restaurant industry, though.
It's gotten way, way better in the last, you know, 10 or 15 years. But, you know, for most of restaurant history, it was like white men were the chefs and they were running the show. Mm-hmm. For the most part, there were exceptions, of course. It's gotten way, way better now. There's much more inclusion. In 2018, the James Beard Foundation said, we need to make some real changes to, A, kind of get these bad apples out of the nomination process to begin with, and B, be more inclusive and sort of think outside our own, you know, box that we've been in for so long about what makes a good chef.
Yeah, totally. So they did do that. They made a concerted effort and were kind of successful pretty much out of the gate. But they became victims of their own ambitions in 2020 when they canceled the James Beard Awards, not just for 2020, but for 2021. And they blamed it on the COVID pandemic, which made sense. But people were also like, well, you know, everybody else has been doing this stuff over Zoom. Like, why would you cancel the whole awards?
Yeah.
And apparently an insider in the foundation, who was also like either a chef or a journalist or whatever, came and told everybody else, that's not why they canceled the awards. They canceled the awards because every single person who won this year, in reality, is white. So they just didn't give out the awards. And that caused a huge stir among everybody in the industry, you know?
Yeah, they covered it up. And this was after trying to do the right thing. And they canceled, like you said, the next one just because they were still sort of reeling from what had happened in, in 2021 because they were still reeling from 2020. Mm-hmm. Finally came back last year in 2022 with the first awards in, I guess, 3 years. And they had a total overhaul of the committee and how they judge. They're saying that, you know, there's an ethics committee now that vets nominees just on a personal level. And then also said, and the way we're judging, like, we need to think about the criteria in different terms as well moving forward.
Yeah, they still don't have it figured out because this ethics committee has become such watchdogs. Or guard dogs, I should say, of the James Beard Awards, that they hire private investigators to investigate the nominees.
Yeah.
And part of the nomination process now is being grilled over Zoom or probably in person now by private investigators working on behalf of the James Beard Ethics Committee. And that soured people in and of itself. So they're like a pendulum that somehow misses the middle every time. It just keeps going from one side to another. And I think they're on the right track. And somebody gave them credit. They said, one chef said that what we're seeing is, quote, an institution self-correct in real time, which is, you know, that's fair. And maybe they should take off another couple of years until they get it figured out. But
yeah.
they're trying at least. And they have been successful some years, but there's just been misstep after misstep as they try to figure this out. It's a big systemic issue, and they're kind of like the vanguard of the whole thing, so people are looking to them more than other places, too.
Yeah, there were two incidences this past year in particular that made the news. One was that a finalist for Best Chef in the South, an Alabama chef named Timothy Hontzis, was disqualified a month before the awards because they were like, he's one of these guys that berates his staff, even yells at customers. He denied this stuff. Said,
he's like, that's,
you know,
not true.
Well, it sounded like he was like, hey, listen, I'm a passionate guy, but this stuff is not how it's being characterized. Mm-hmm. But one of the real problems is they didn't communicate that to the committee members that they had disqualified it. Like, they found out about it in the press.
Oh, wow.
And a lot of other chefs and judges, because I think there's like 600 ultimate judges, mm-hmm. that are like chefs and food writers and journalists all over the country. Mm-hmm. A few of those quit. One called it fake virtue signaling. One smashed his previous award. Another stepped down in protest. And then this Kentucky chef named Sam Four was a finalist for Best Chef Southeast. And she said that she was questioned, like given basically no notice, questioned over Zoom by these investigators over social media posts mm-hmm. where she had spoken out against domestic violence and sexual assault. And the way this goes, the way this happens is anonymous tipsters calling in. So you can call in and anonymously say anything you want about someone. And all of a sudden you're being investigated without any like prior, you know, warning of what is even going on. So all of a sudden she's on this Zoom and they're saying that she was it was targeted harassment and bullying because of some tweets that she sent out sort of exposing stories of sexual assault. But she never named anybody. Mm-hmm. And she told the people, she's like, how can you accuse me of targeted harassment if after an hour you still don't know who I'm targeting?
Right.
Like, I didn't name anybody. And she was, you know, obviously really upset about this. And it just seems like there's way too much secrecy around how it goes down, these investigations. They don't have a real, true, like, day in court for the accused. It's just they're kind of just almost surprised, it seems like. And, you know, before you know it, then they're not in consideration. And they're like, well, wait a minute, I didn't even get a chance to plead my case in full.
It sounds Kafkaesque.
Yeah. Bourdain has always been very critical. He had a lot of bad stuff to say about the Beard Awards over the years.
I'm sure.
Funny stuff. A lot of it about not being inclusive and like, who do you think you're kidding by saying you're now inclusive, stuff like that. And it's just like, he wasn't an award guy. He's kind of like the people who bash the Oscars and just like, just a bunch of industry people, you know, self, you know, patting each other on the back.
Yeah. I'll always remember a tweet from him at like right when Baby Driver came out and everybody was crazy uh-huh. for it. All it said was F Baby Driver, but he didn't say F. And it was just three words that completely undermined everybody else. It was really kind of masterful.
Bourdain. Love that guy.
So, yeah. One thing, though, Chuck, just to wrap this all up. To me, James Beard is still such an enigma and confusing. I have no idea what he would make of this award scandal stuff.
Well, I mean, none of the awards came about until he was gone, so he might be like, I don't even like the idea of these awards. Who
yeah,
knows?
Who knows? Not
or maybe he would.
Yeah, we don't know. If you want to know anything more about James Beard, there's a lot out there. You can also start with his cookbooks, too, which are allegedly quite good. Chuck's going to let all of us know about his onion sandwiches.
I'm going to do
and
it.
And since Chuck said, I'm going to do it, we've just triggered listener mail.
Oh, by the way, that onion should be a sweet white onion. So a Vidalia is a great choice.
Isn't a Vidalia a sweet yellow onion?
It is yellow, but maybe the sweet overrides the color.
Sure.
What you don't want is a red onion.
Okay, I could see that. That's a real, that's those are harsh. Distinct, yeah.
Yeah. All right, I'm going to call this reality. We did that episode as Reality Real mm-hmm. and got a lot of great feedback on it. People seem to enjoy kind of breaking their brains momentarily. At mm-hmm. Hey guys, just listen to that episode. Thumbs up for daring to tackle such a subject that one could get really in the weeds about. For example, one could argue that each other's human's reality is different from one another. Mm-hmm. The whole idea of perception is reality, and everyone's perception is different. Then one must ask what the definition of reality is. I think we kind of talked about that a little bit, didn't
uh-huh.
we? Okay. Anyhow, all that aside, one question I was never able to understand why it's even a question is if a tree falls in the woods and no one's around to hear it, does it make a sound? Doesn't science tell us that sound is caused by friction and vibration? That tree would have to pull off one heck of a trick to fall without causing any kind of friction and vibration. And furthermore, what makes us so important that a tree would put on a friction and vibration show only when we're present? Am I missing something here with this
yes.
tree sound issue? I've just never understood why that's a question, at least because we are in the presence and know about science. But then again, science also can't seem to talk some out of the flat earth theory either, which is reality for some. Love the pod. Keep up the great work. And that is Corey in Omaha, Nebraska.
Thanks a lot, Corey. I guess to kind of answer that a little bit as best I can. I can't even. This has been too... My brain's broken. Let me just stop that.
Well, I think you kind of answered it in that episode.
Yeah. I mean, I guess we did. You know? Yeah. It's funny that Corey brings this up because there's something that hit me the other day, too. Like, when we did the reality episode, I totally understood everything that we were saying. It all made mm-hmm. sense to me. And then an mm-hmm. airplane flew overhead. Mm-hmm. And I wondered why I was witnessing hearing an airplane fly overhead that I was not expecting. That has nothing to do with my life other than the fact that I can hear it and it's flying overhead. Mm-hmm. Why would that exist?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. The best I can come up with is that it exists for those other people and they just happen to be passing by the space that I'm occupying at the time and I'm within earshot, so it happens for me. I don't know. I can't quite connect those dots, so I kind of get what Corey's saying there.
Yeah, I get it too. I don't like to think about this stuff.
I love it. I'll think about it for both of us.
Oh, great.
Well, if you want to get in touch with us like Corey did and break our brains a little further, we'd love to hear from you. You can send us an email to stuffpodcast@iheartradio.com.
Stuff You Should Know is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Looking for a fabulous fashion brand that celebrates you? Then look no further than Boston Proper, where styles are designed with you in mind, so you can look and feel amazing, no matter the day, season, or occasion. At bostonproper.com, you'll find fashion that knows you best. For over 30 years, Boston Proper has been the fashion destination for confident women who want to elevate their look with unique, sophisticated clothing at affordable prices. Visit bostonproper.com today. Boston Proper. Wear it like no one else.
Hey, if you haven't heard of Visible, well, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible. It's in the name. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon as low as $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. Use promo code STUFF20 to receive $20 off your first month for listening to this podcast. Switch now at Visible.com. For data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com. The Visible monthly rate is $25 per month.
In Puerto Rico, there's adventure around every corner and natural treasures waiting to be explored, like El Yunque, the only tropical rainforest in the U.S. Get swept away by natural beauty and come away with unique stories that could only be experienced in Puerto Rico and that remind you why you travel in the first place. Visits end, but stories last forever. You don't become a part of the island, it becomes a part of you. No passports required for U.S. citizens and permanent residents. Learn more and plan your trip at discoverpuertorico.com.